introduced him to the possibility that a steady diet of fast food and cherry Cokes might not be the best for him, or even a steady stream of all-white shirts. I may also have influenced his spending habits to some extent. He was parsimonious in the extreme. Once, when we were together at an airport, I asked him for a dime to make a phone call. He started to walk some distance to get change for a quarter. "Warren," I exclaimed, "the quarter will do." And he sheepishly handed it over. Beyond acquainting him with a few new foods and slightly more varied clothing, I also introduced him to a wide variety of people in journalism and government. In my early years of knowing him, I was convinced that Warren's gifts were so extraordinary that he, like my father and my husband, would eventually tire of making money and want to perform public service and be engaged in world events. In this, I misjudged him. What he loves is business, thinking and reading and talking about business. He is acute about public issues, but I can't imagine him in government. Warren is only happy when he is unconstrained, totally in control of his own life, not forced to go to meetings or dinners he doesn't want to go to, or see people who don't interest him, or do things he doesn't enjoy. Warren has done so many things for me, but among the most important are the inroads he has made on my insecurities. Just as Ben had always reassured me on the editorial side of the Post, Warren, with his store of analogies and anecdotes, Buffettisms I call them, and his constant bolstering, was very comforting to me. Early in our friendship, I wrote him that, "I didn't know when I heard from you that you had become a large holder of Washington Post stock, that although your dividends might not make you rich, my dividends and psychic income would triple." Warren not only knows business, but he knows the communications business in a way that I didn't then and don't now. He never calmed me down by false optimism, but rather by shedding the light of reality as he saw it on whatever it was that was haunting me. He was always accessible, almost like having a personal business psychiatrist. Warren is humanly wise, too, so naturally I began to share with him things in my private life. His comments always helped. One day I called him because I had been hurt by a friend. "Don't forget," he told me, "she has zero-based affection," meaning that you always had to start from scratch, with no reservoir of goodwill or of love. He knew me so well that he instinctively knew what might work with me. He once told me that someone in a Dale Carnegie course had said to him, "Just remember, we're not going to teach you how to keep your knees from knocking. All we're going to do is teach you to talk while your knees knock." That's what he then turned around and passed on to me. He helped me learn how to talk while my knees knocked. Warren summed up our learning relationship by suggesting that I seemed to go around as though I were seeing myself through the distorting mirrors of a carnival funhouse. He saw it as his task to get me a better mirror that could eliminate the distortions. He later told me that he subscribed to Charlie Munger's orangutan theory, which essentially contended that if a smart person goes into a room with an orangutan and explains whatever his or her idea is, the orangutan just sits there eating his banana, and at the end of the conversation, the person explaining comes out smarter. Warren claimed to be my orangutan, and in a way he was. I heard myself talk when I was with him, and I always got a better idea of what I was saying. At about the same time that Warren came on the board, several things heated up within the company, particularly on the labor front. We had experienced a nightmare spring when the Star had decided to conduct separate bargaining meetings with the printers and had arrived at a separate settlement with the ITU, which was a serious break in our unity and one that very much disturbed me. Our summer had been as bad as our spring, with work stoppages and problems from both the pressmen and the printers. Negotiations with the printers had broken down in the face of many of their frivolous demands, like asking for a holiday for my birthday and then claiming we weren't bargaining in good faith if we wouldn't discuss it at the table. Eventually, on September 22, 1974, after 14 months of agonizing on-again, off-again, tough bargaining, the Post and the printers finally signed a 6-year contract. This was a watershed document that permitted gradual automation in the composing room and gave 700 post-printers lifetime jobs. We had the right to reduce that number through attrition and buyouts. Most important, The contract ended the practice of reproduce, which by this point had mounted to the point where the per-page cost accrual was $84. We paid about $2.5 million to members of the union to get rid of the bogus. Ominously for the future, John Prescott reported on a conversation he had with Charlie Davis of the Stereotypers Union, who said that if he had been a printer, he would never have given up reproduce. The rest of us, however, were ecstatic. It was a landmark occasion and another essential and giant step forward. John Prescott deserves great credit for the final settlement with the ITU, which we had been striving for years. It was expensive, in that we had to guarantee hundreds of jobs which had no reason for existing in the first place. The New York papers had set this precedent. But it was fair to both sides. Most significantly, it got rid of the worst problem that confronted us, and the worst running sore in our sides, the constant confrontations with, animosity from, and slowdowns by the printers, which in turn helped us allay the potentially disastrous discontent brewing with the circulation dealers. Most of the dealers liked our system of their being independent businesses. The system paid them well, and there were healthy incentives, as long as they didn't have to cope with the problems of the long waits resulting from the slowdowns. But now the dissidents among the dealers created a new threat for us. They wanted to set their own prices for the paper. We met this danger by working out a deal that converted the dealers to an agency system, whereby they got paid for distribution of our paper, which we, not they, owned. The incentives remained good in a way that was both fair and profitable for them. This practice, too, was accepted, and the agency form of organization was actually picked up and copied by other papers. Given these successes, it would seem as though John Prescott had a solid record, but in fact it was mixed. I continued to think that we were not making enough progress, and there was still a lack of firmness with the unions. With some reluctance, together with Larry Israel, who had been president of the company since Fritz's death, I decided that we needed a stronger hand at the helm at the Post. With the acquisition of the Trenton Times, which we had made earlier in 1974, and the hoped-for acquisition of other papers, we promoted John Prescott to head of the newspaper division, which we established to include our share of the International Herald Tribune, our newsprint manufacturer Bowater Mersey, the news service, and our newsprint warehouse. We also brought Mark Mayer down from New York, where he had been based since mid-1970, serving the company as vice president for finance and administration. He now became executive vice president and general manager of the Post, reporting directly to me as publisher. Our timing couldn't have been worse, coming as it did on the very day we were to ratify the new contract with the printers' union. I got a fair amount of flack over the decision about Prescott, but it was made, as always, with enough consensus from those whose judgment I trusted that I felt it was right. So Mark Mayer took up the reins on the business side of the Post. What he found was ill will throughout the building and low morale among the middle managers because of personnel changes. On the whole, the unions regarded management as incompetent, yet able enough to try deviously to set them up as scapegoats for all of the problems that could more clearly be laid at management's own door. Mark was relatively new to newspapering, but learned fast and did a fine job, beginning right away to get things in better shape. He worked hard on labor issues and trusted Larry Wallace to keep a steady hand on the rudder. Larry was a first-rate negotiator, but for years he took incredible heat for being tough and fearless in bargaining sessions. Mark did very well, too, in both labor relations and in equal employment, in promoting and hiring women and minorities, and bringing a renewed vigor to the business side of the paper. But the pressmen particularly were giving us a lot of problems. What it came down to was that, after years of concessions to their union, of deals made over the water cooler, of surrenderings in order to avoid a strike at all costs, we were no longer in control of our own pressroom. We knew that to move forward we had to regain control, and in order to do that, we had to eliminate some of the more excessive clauses and feather bedding that reduced productivity, tied our hands, prevented us from managing the future of the paper, and threatened the economic well-being of the Post. Accordingly, early in 1975, we informed the Pressman's Local that in our negotiations toward a new contract, we would insist on revision of those practices. As 1975 wore on, we retrained executives in all the production processes needed if we were ever forced to publish without the craft unions. Many of those who had gone to Oklahoma City for the original training had not taken it very seriously. Now we sent several people down to the Miami Herald to brush up on their production skills. On September 17th, Mark and I went to call on Joe Albritton, who by then was acquainted with the lay of the land at the Star. We hoped he would understand the importance of sticking together for the Pressman's Union negotiations. As I put it to Joe in this meeting, if we had to settle with the pressmen, it would undoubtedly affect the Star's situation in the long run. Not surprisingly, Joe turned us down, saying he could not afford to spend another 50 cents. With the Star losing $1 million a month at the time, he was probably right, but it seemed short-sighted to me. After this, I thought about our undergoing a strike while the other paper was publishing and concluded that we couldn't win, largely because no one ever had. If the other paper published, advertisers had a way to reach people, and the struck paper simply would wither on the vine, unless, of course, it could continue to publish. I concluded that we would be operating at such a tremendous disadvantage that we couldn't possibly take a strike at this time without endangering the paper's existence. It certainly was a bad time for a strike. The Star was gaining momentum. Albritton was a fast learner, and, as Warren Buffett recalled, a strike at the Post was his sole hope, really. "If you owned the Star," Warren suggested, "the way you were going to win was to have the Post shut down. If not, you were going to lose." If Albritton prayed for anything, he prayed for you not publishing for a considerable period of time while people developed different reading habits. In my discussions with Mark in the late summer and early fall of 1975, I told him not to get us into a situation where we risked a strike. I was clear in saying that perhaps it would be better to extend the contract for a year or make yet another short-run deal than to take a strike alone. Mark pointed out that we were not negotiating with the union over strike issues, but that we had asked our supervisors to start managing, and we had to back them up with measures that would permit them to do that. We agreed to live with most of our contract rules a while longer, to settle for a single contract change or two in order to show that change was coming, but to try to avoid a strike. Contracts with 9 of the craft unions, including the pressmen, who by now had combined with the stereotypers, were all scheduled to run out on October 1, 1975. We approached that date fully expecting a tough time and long negotiations. What we got was the unexpected. Chapter 26. Very early in the morning of October 1, 1975, I was awakened out of a sound sleep by the loud ringing of the phone next to my bed. Groggily, I looked at the clock as I reached for the phone and was mystified. It was about 4:45 a.m. What could it mean? We had feared the midnight deadline when the contracts between the Washington Post and its unions were set to expire. In fact, I'd been so worried that I had returned early to Washington from meetings in Florida. I phoned Mark Mayer when I got back. "Should I come to the paper?" "No," he replied. "Everything was quiet. All the executives would be there in case anything happened. There was every indication that the negotiations would continue beyond the deadline." So I went to bed, thinking that if midnight came and went with no problem, both sides would carry on with the back-and-forth bargaining. My phone call was from Mark. The pressmen had Pearl Harbored us, running the presses past midnight to throw us off about their intentions, and then, at about 4 a.m., just before the end of the press run, disabling all 72 printing units of the 9 presses. Having done severe damage in a variety of ways, including setting fire to one press and brutally beating the pressroom foreman, Jim Hover, who had come out of his office to see what was slowing the presses, the pressmen, Local 6 of the Newspaper and Graphic Communications Union, walked out, taking with them the other craft unions, and started picketing. There was no time to think. I dressed hastily, jumped in the car without waking my driver, who lived nearby, and drove myself down quiet, dark Massachusetts Avenue to 15th Street. When I rounded the corner to the Post's building, I witnessed a frightening sight. The street was ablaze with lights and action, with fire engines, police, television cameras, and hundreds of pickets massed around the building. A policeman stood in the middle of the street, blocking traffic from entering. I pulled up, explained who I was, and said that I needed to go in, but hesitated to drive alone into the parking lot next door to the building.
"Leave the car right there," he told me. "I'll watch it."
I pulled over, got out, and began walking down the middle of the street, where the picketers saw me coming. For a moment, I was worried that they would try to prevent me from entering, or worse, hurt me. But I suppose I assumed they would not hurt a woman, which later turned out not to be the case. As it was, I put my head down and plowed through the picket line into the side entrance. Once inside, I experienced a sort of reverse drama, a quiet, empty, dark building with no one in sight. Almost all of the executives and managers had gone home at about 2 a.m., when everything seemed quiet, and when Larry Wallace had reported that negotiations would continue. Mark had called them to come back in, but they were upstairs conferring. I went downstairs to look at the deserted press room. What I saw shocked and saddened me. Clearly there had been a riot of sorts. A foot of water covered the floor. The smell of smoke was everywhere. Ben later described the place as looking like the engine room in a burned-out ship's hulk. I don't remember seeing a soul in the entire area, maybe a remaining fireman or two. It was eerie, standing there looking at the damage. I went up to the 7th floor, where I found Mark and the assembling executives. Mark explained to us what had happened. When the previous night's negotiating session had ended at about 9:30, Dugan had handed Wallace a letter saying that his men were terminating the contract but were willing to continue to work under its terms only as long as meaningful negotiations continue. Because a federal mediator had scheduled more negotiations, and because Larry had had conversations with several union representatives to the effect that the other unions were willing to forego scheduled negotiating sessions with the company for a few days while the negotiations with the pressmen continued, both he and Mark had assumed that those negotiations would carry on. The first Mark knew that this was not to be was when Jim Hover, bleeding profusely from a head wound, walked into his office. Our gathering in Mark's office soon after 5 a.m. that first day was the beginning of what turned into several months of high drama and intense challenge. I never wanted a strike, and had definitively told Mark and our managers to avoid one if possible, and once it began, I agreed with Mark, who said at the very beginning, "We don't want this strike to last 1 second longer than is necessary." However, none of the preparations we had made for publishing in case of a brief strike, which was the most we feared, had included the possibility of trouble such as had occurred. We were stunned by having the presses so badly damaged. Electrical wiring had been ripped out, essential operating parts removed, oil drained out to strip the gears, and newsprint rolls slashed, and by having almost all the craft unions in the building out on strike together. The first thing we had to deal with was the reporters who started to come into work unaware of what had taken place. We set up tours of the press room for anyone who had come into the building through the picket lines. These tours were Ben's idea. Once he saw how extensive the destruction was and how premeditated it had been, for example, fire extinguishers tampered with and fires then set, he was convinced that the reporters needed to see for themselves what had happened to get the facts, so that they could make an informed choice. Most of these newspaper guild members were as shocked as the rest of us. That afternoon they held a boisterous meeting at which many of them criticized the damage and violence. Brian Flores and the rest of the paid hierarchy of the guild strongly urged them to support the pressmen and denied that much damage had occurred. The guild, however, in a voice vote, voted overwhelmingly against a motion to honor the picket line. Except for the very small union representing those who worked in building services, the guild was the only one of the Post's unions to cross the picket line. Some guild members decided to honor it, but most stayed in. The great majority of them were troubled and torn, but they were at work, for which we were grateful, although we knew that their presence was tenuous and might grow more so as time passed.
The battle of public relations started immediately. Luckily, we had hired Ted Van Dyke to take care of our PR in case of trouble, so we were able quickly to release a statement explaining what had happened, and then to keep up a steady beat of bulletins throughout the strike, explaining the position of the Post's management and the rationale for our actions. The Pressmen's Union put forth its own public relations effort, accusing the Post of being responsible for the frustration of its members. Their party line was that the Post was outrageously trying to eliminate important clauses negotiated in previous contracts. The first few days of the strike were particularly wild, punctuated by court procedures and attempts on our part to get organized. October 1st was taken up with ad hoc planning. All but about 50,000 copies of Wednesday's issue of the Post had been printed, and those were distributed. While we were assessing the extent of the damage and whether the worst-hit presses were permanently ruined, we announced that there would be no paper the next day and had no guess as to when we would be able to resume publication, but Mark added that the editorial staff was going about its normal work and that we intended to publish soon, somehow, somewhere. One of our first concerns was the personal safety of those who were working and would be daily crossing the picket line. This worry led us to seek a temporary restraining order that would restrict the pickets from violent acts, in part by limiting the number of pickets who could be outside the building in any given period. We managed to get a court order about 24 hours after the initial violence, but despite this, a smoke bomb was thrown through a window in our photo studio, and there was indiscriminate swinging at people going in and out of the building. Kathy Sawyer, a reporter, was struck on the head with a chunk of wood, and V. Curtis, a circulation manager, got punched. Unfortunately for the union, so did Maurice Cullinane, D.C.'s chief of police, who was coming into the building in civilian dress. The police made more than 20 arrests, most of them for disorderly conduct, but one of someone carrying a gun. At the same time that we were addressing safety concerns, we moved quickly to make sure we could publish as soon as possible. Someone had previously been in touch with several small non-union suburban papers about printing parts of the paper in the event of a strike. By 7 a.m., we were already on the phone to these papers to see what could be done. On the morning of October 2nd, Mark and I went to see Joe Albritton to propose the idea that the Star print the Post on its presses, which would, of course, have resulted in that paper's being shut down, too, in solidarity with us. Knowing that Joe had refused to negotiate with us in the first place, I realized that he probably wouldn't agree, but I felt I had to try. As I assumed would happen, he refused to help us. Meanwhile, at the Post, Roger Parkinson, one of Mark's young assistants, a Harvard MBA newly arrived from Newsweek, got to work trying to find a way to move the pages, if we could set them, from our building to the outside small plants for printing. Having been in a Green Beret unit in Vietnam, Roger thought of helicopters and had the wit to look under H in the yellow pages, where he found a company willing to contract for the flights. Then he turned his attention to where the helicopters might land. The parking lot was dismissed as being too close to the picketers. The roof was chosen as being safer. Immediately, John Tansel, one of the Post's old guard, who was in charge of the building, said it was impossible, the roof wouldn't hold the weight. When it was decided that Tansel could be proved wrong only by a test landing on the roof, Roger swung into action, checking first with the district police, who gave us permission, and then with the White House, because of regulations forbidding flights near it. Permission was granted, though with the stipulation that since Emperor Hirohito was in town, we couldn't fly south of K Street, just one block away from our building, which would take us too close to the White House. Then the State Department had to be called, because the embassy of the Soviet Union was right behind the Post's building. State said that we couldn't do it, to which we responded that we had to. At one point, the pressmen went to the Federal Aviation Administration to try to stop the helicopters. I argued our case to Bill Coleman, then Secretary of Transportation, and the FAA stuck with us. Once all the pieces were in place, we flew in a test helicopter. John Waits of production ran up the stairs to the roof with the film that first night and handed it to Roger, who in turn handed it over to the pilot. We all cheered as the helicopter took off. I was on the roof, watching in amazement, and in my great excitement, realizing this would work, I hugged everyone in sight. From then on, I held my breath each time a helicopter came in or took off. I wasn't the only one frightened by the risks involved. In the early days, when we needed electricians and engineers to help us repair the presses, at least one man said that crossing the picket line was less frightening for him than being helicoptered into the building via the roof. We had missed one day of publishing the post and didn't intend to miss any more. We had identified 6 plants that agreed to print the post. Don, pale with fury, appeared in my office later on that second day, the very day that I had gone to see Al Britton, to say that not only was the Star not going to help us, but it was going to publish the name of one of the plants that would be printing our paper, almost an invitation to the picketers to start beating up people there as well. I called Joe immediately and suggested that if this was so, it might get someone killed. Joe replied that he was unaware this was happening and asked who could possibly be doing it. I exploded, "I don't know, Joe, but if you can't find out who in your goddamn paper is doing it, I can't help you." This was an unneeded outburst of temper, but we were all very tense. The Star didn't print the name of the paper at that time. Some of the plants that helped us actually revealed the fact themselves. Working out helicopter landing sites at each of the small plants was highly complicated. Sometimes there was only a football field lit with the headlights of cars. At the other end of the process, the circulation department had to work out inconceivably complicated routes to pick up the papers at each of the plants for delivery back to Washington and its surrounding suburbs. Because different papers' production centers would get tired, they were printing their own paper as well as parts of ours, some would give up or take a break, which meant that each day our planners had to start virtually from scratch, replanning landing sites and delivery schedules. Despite all the logistic difficulties, on October 3rd, with only one day of not publishing, the Post printed and distributed to our readers, late but nevertheless there, a limited 24-page edition of 500,000 that had been printed in the 6 small plants ringing the Washington area. It was a halting beginning, but a real and significant triumph. Knowing that we couldn't ask these plants to print their own paper and ours indefinitely, we set to work to try to get our presses up and running again. To complicate matters further, the Goss Company, which made the presses we owned, was on strike, so parts were hard to obtain. I personally called the international president of the Machinists Union, who was in San Francisco, where the AFL-CIO was having a national meeting, and asked him to let union machinists fix our presses. I pleaded with him that we had to fix the presses and told him that we hoped to stay with union labor, but that if the union machinists couldn't come into the building, we would have to bring in others. He remained adamant, so other newspapers, mostly non-union but a few union, lent us machinists, particularly electricians and engineers, to begin to repair the damage. We hired guards to establish better security around the plant, which had the desired effect of encouraging more people to come in to work. Though more guild members came in, the guild issued a bulletin calling on both sides to resume negotiations, criticizing Larry Wallace's tactics, and appointing a 3-member committee to monitor negotiations and report back to the membership in 1 week. The guild forbade its members to perform any work other than their own, essentially preventing members from helping us in any way. A few brave people did so anyway. Throughout the long months of the strike, but especially in those first few wild days, there were fervent discussions, heated arguments, vituperative bulletins, and repeated meetings among guild members, with the guild officers threatening and cajoling, while the members continued to vote to stay in, although the margin of votes grew increasingly narrow. 2 days after that overwhelming voice vote on the first day of the strike, when the guild voted again to stay in, the vote was 244 to 186. On October 3rd, I went to a meeting of publishers at the headquarters of the American Newspaper Publishers Association in Reston, Virginia. I knew they had invited Joe Albritton and me separately to talk to the members. I gave the publishers a full account of what had happened to date and where we stood in negotiations and in continuing to publish. I took with me photographs of the pressroom, evidence of what had taken place. Basically, my fellow publishers asked me if this was the time to get together in a joint operating agreement with the Star. Answer, no. They also asked if I intended to go all the way, by which they meant, did I intend to bust the union and never let its members back. My response to this was that I didn't know how things would develop, but that we expected to publish while trying to negotiate with the union. We would do the best we could under the circumstances. I consistently refused to promise to get rid of the union because I wasn't going to risk the paper over something we might not be able to achieve. Some of the publishers said that if I didn't promise to go that far, they wouldn't help. I said I was sorry if that was the case, because we obviously badly needed all kinds of help, but I couldn't promise to do something that might not be possible to do. At that point, I was less focused on ultimate goals, not even being sure what our goals should be, and more resolved on getting the presses fixed and publishing the Post temporarily without the craft unions, but from our own plant. After I had finished my presentation and was on my way out, a good friend of mine, Frank Daniels, publisher of the Raleigh News and Observer, jumped in the car to keep me company on the ride back to Washington. Frank spoke with a strong southern accent, and I'll never forget his words or his inflection and meaning.
"Watch out, sugar. They want you to bust the union."
Despite the warning from Frank and the one issued at the meeting, much of the industry was extremely helpful, and several papers supported us valiantly throughout. By Sunday, October 5th, we were still publishing a clearly curtailed and money-losing newspaper, printed by the remote plants, which of course we were paying. On October 6th, I met with those people who were still working so that I could tell them what we intended to do. The first thing I did was to address the union charges of bad faith negotiating and union busting by stating firmly my own belief in the value of unions. I do not expect that all our outlooks will be exactly alike. In the normal and healthy tension that exists between unions and management, they could not and should not be. That tension, peacefully and lawfully expressed and peacefully and lawfully resolved in contract negotiations, is one of the great goads to the constant improvement of our paper. It keeps us moving toward a better, sounder, more stable, and securer enterprise. That tension, in short, is good for all of us. It is good for the Washington Post. Because I believe this so firmly, and because this conception of the value and importance of unionism has been so firmly a part of the tradition of my family and of those who have worked to make this newspaper great over the years, I hope you will bear with me while I address the general charges that have been made. We have been accused of an attempt at union busting and of bad faith negotiations with a view to union busting. I realize that these accusations are often merely part of the rhetoric thrown about in a period of labor management strain, but they happen to be charges that I take very seriously, and yes, very personally. They are false. I believe in the right to organize, to bargain, and to strike. I believe also in the right to publish. But I do not believe in the right to vandalize, frighten, destroy, and assault. I do not believe in the right of any union to create conditions under which members of other unions would have been unable to work, even if a negotiated settlement had been reached. Some of us in this room, let us not pretend otherwise, have had our severe differences in the past over what is desirable and what is just in a contract settlement, and we shall no doubt have them in the future. But we do not disagree on this. We say no to violence, no to brute intimidation, no to the calculated destruction of other people's and other unions' opportunity to work, or even to choose whether to work. I especially addressed guild members, saying how much I appreciated and didn't take for granted their presence in the building. I honestly felt that those who were there had made a hard choice and a brave decision. I also told them that I knew they too would strike if they felt the management was being unfair vis-à-vis the pressmen. I assured them that the channels of communication in our building, though imperfect, were nevertheless open, adding, "When you think we are doing something wrong, we will listen. Within our walls, as at the negotiating table, we are trying to do what is morally right and what is humanly right before we are trying to do anything else." Mark then spoke, and he also said that we were willing to resume negotiations with the pressmen. The violence, of course, complicated the negotiations immeasurably. We sued the union for damages, and a grand jury began investigating the violence. By that evening, one press was fixed. We had a crew ready to run it, a group of advertising executives and others, including a woman, which was quite a historic breakthrough in itself. This special press crew was led by Joe Arcaro, a much-beloved figure, who was head of retail sales. The crucial moment had arrived, but could our amateur and barely trained executives really run a press? The press looked so huge and complex and forbidding that it was almost impossible to believe it could work. Many of us, Ben and I included, were in the pressroom that night watching to see what would happen.
"Go, Joe, baby!" Ben yelled out,
and incredibly but surely, the press roared into action. We printed 100,000 papers that very night. The next and even greater drama took place on the platform, after the papers had made their way through the mailroom, where they'd been bundled by another crew of executives and sent down the chutes to the waiting trucks. The back platform was all lit up, and the whole alley was electric with tension and excitement. Don Graham was there to help load the first truck, which was to be driven by an extremely brave distributor, with another one riding shotgun, in a nearly literal sense. Meg and I were both on hand, waiting and watching. There was a police car ahead of the truck, and one behind. To loud jeering from the picketers, the trucks left the alley and were escorted safely to the district line. It was an electric moment, filled with symbolism for those of us watching. The Newspaper Guild was steadily putting out bulletins to the post unit. One that first week said that many of its members were not going to work because they couldn't cross the pressman's picket line and because they bitterly resent management's efforts to intimidate guild members who are still working inside the building and those who have chosen to stay out. The guild reminded its members that the situation was fluid and could change at any time. On October 7th, the guild voted a third time to stay in, but this time by an even smaller margin, 270 to 251. Oddly, the pressmen actually managed to help us in our efforts to keep the guild working. Whenever we were extremely nervous, they would pull some stunt that outraged guild members and helped keep them in. One such occurred when Jules Whitcover, a popular and star reporter, was beaten up as he walked to the garage to get his car, chipping his teeth and requiring several stitches close to his eye. Also on October 7th, we held our first bargaining session with the pressmen, under the auspices of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service. It was an all-day session that Mark characterized as helpful and constructive. A second negotiating team, also under the supervision of Larry Wallace, was to begin meeting the next day with the machinists and electricians' unions. In the meantime, Joe Arcaro's crew had more than doubled their output, printing over 200,000 papers that night. And with 16 non-union engineers from newspapers around the country working to repair our damaged presses, we hoped to have a second press running soon. We did so by October 9th, when we ran 280,000 copies of the paper in our own plant, and anticipated phasing out the use of the satellite plants as more of our presses were repaired. Still, we estimated a daily loss of $300,000 in advertising revenues compared with our normal lineage that was going into the Star. Once the presses were fixed, we principally needed able electricians and machinists, workers with skills that were difficult to acquire by amateurs, and which our executives lacked, but without which we couldn't publish. The Post's 300 circulation dealers were absolutely instrumental in all of this, since it would have done us no good to be able to print, but then not distribute. The dealers were spirited and courageous, not to mention patient and resolute, despite all kinds of violence against them personally. Within a week, we were delivering to homes and newsstands at a near normal level. The only papers not going out in the first few weeks were the 10,000 mailed copies and those leaving town by bus, train, and airplane. For these, Jack Patterson, vice president of circulation, decided he needed help and proposed to hire outsiders. Don's naturally cautious nature made him resist this request. He felt that the pressman might use the opportunity to smuggle someone into the building to hurt us. After listening to Don for a while, Jack, with all his independence and drive, ignored him and hired the outsiders. Preparing the mailing for the large Sunday papers was time-consuming and dirty. For that, Jack recruited volunteers. Meg, Howard, Phil Jalen, Liz Hilton, and I responded to his call, as did many others, and we worked in the mailroom on Saturday nights throughout the strike, as well as on several other nights during the week. We went on duty when the presses started to run at about 9:30 p.m., and at first didn't finish until 3 or 4 a.m. It was a tough job that left us filthy, sweaty, and covered with paste. We had to roll up each individual paper in a brown wrapper, paste on an address label, seal the whole thing shut, and throw the finished wrapped package into the big, smelly, heavy, and unwieldy canvas bags at the side of the work table, which we then dragged over to another station, from which they were finally hauled off to the post office. This was the only time in my life that I regretted the substantial circulation the post had outside of Washington. The whole job was so tedious and interminable that we came to look on it as our supreme service for the cause, the ultimate sacrifice. Warren Buffett, who spent several Saturday nights in the mailroom with us, said it made him rethink the price of the Sunday paper. No price was sufficient. For the first 10 days of the strike, we operated at an extraordinarily high level of activity and in a state of particularly high pressure. There were constant meetings of top management. The tensions for all of us were indescribable, and the strain on me was the worst I have ever experienced. The uncertainties, the difficulties, the violence against the people who were working, the fear that the Star would use the opportunity to turn the tables, were all overwhelming. I felt desperate, and secretly wondered if I might have blown the whole thing and lost the paper. I didn't really see how we were going to manage. The only way I can describe the extent of my anxiety is to say that I felt as if I were pregnant with a rock. Yet, despite my inner turmoil, I had to appear calm and determined and to come across as optimistic in order to convey that attitude to others. One of the toughest pressures that was brought to bear on me came in a meeting with Ed Williams and Ben, together with Mark and Don. I know that Ed and Ben thought they had the best interests of the paper at heart, but Ed, at least, clearly thought we were committing suicide by not giving in to the pressmen's demands. Ed was a lawyer with superb judgment about almost everything, but I felt he didn't understand the issues in this case, or all that lay behind the strike, and how important it was that we not give in. On top of everything else, he told us in no uncertain terms that we seemed to be operating under some delusion that we were actually putting out a paper. He said, "I read it in the car coming to work. It takes me 5 minutes, and then I throw it on the floor. Joe Albritton is eating your lunch. You have to give in and take the unions back." I'm not sure what Ben's view was at that moment, except that I know he always cared above all for editorial quality, so it must have pained him to hear Ed say this about the paper he had worked so hard to build. I also know that he was worried about the people who worked for him, the reporters and editors, who remained deeply distressed, and perhaps he had been persuaded by Ed that we were wrong. But Mark, Don, and I had no doubts. We just shook our heads and said we had no choice but to go forward and carry on as best we could. The meeting with Ed and Ben bothered me because I loved and valued them and continued to do so, but it didn't shake my conviction, or Don's or Mark's, for a minute. One day, during those particularly agonizing first few weeks, I was sitting in my office brooding when Meg came in and quickly realized how sunk I was. I knew I could discuss my real feelings with her, because I trusted her discretion, and I told her I literally thought I couldn't stand the tension. I was paralyzed with fear, and thought I might break. She said something that sounds strange, but in fact gave me comforting relief. "Don't forget, there is an alternative," Meg said. "You can give up. You are in control of that decision. And keeping that in mind can help you stay in as long as you want." Neither one of us thought this a serious alternative, but the very idea relieved my desperate sense of being trapped. Somehow, acknowledging that I had an alternative, however horrible, lessened my dread. Another tremendously helpful friend was Warren, who arrived within the first week and came to stay with me periodically throughout the strike. He later confessed that he came almost at once because Mark Mayer and Don had realized what personal tension I was under and had suggested he come. Warren was at my house on the second Sunday morning of the strike when the post was delivered. We were like two children, standing at the door, amazed to think that we had printed nearly 650,000 copies of the paper in our own plant, only about 50,000 short of the normal press run. As an 88-page paper, it looked fairly respectable, too, although less than one-fourth of its normal size. Our satisfaction and pride were short-lived, however, because the Star arrived a few minutes later, while we were still smiling, so thick with advertising that we could hardly lift it. It was 192 pages, more than twice the size of its Sunday paper on the week before the strike.
"It was a whopper," Warren recalled. "There was no question about it."
In addition to being constantly supportive, Warren offered substantive advice.
"Look," he said, "I'll watch it for you. If I ever think you are in danger of losing and have to give up, I'll tell you."
That was a great comfort. I knew that his judgment on this, as on so much else, would be right. He was watching for what he called the tipping point. As he later explained it, "When you're down for one day, it doesn't change anything. If you're down for a year, you've lost your whole enterprise. Where in between do the lines cross?" What he was watching for was that line-crossing point. Looking back, he admitted, "You didn't come near that point when you were in serious danger of losing the company. But it's like looking for a cure for cancer. You either find the cure or you die in 6 months, and if you find one in the fourth month, you say there was nothing to it." Warren told me later that he knew it was, for me, life or death. Yet at the same time, you can't look to the troops or do anything as though you aren't in control of yourself. But if you really understand the situation, you know you shouldn't be in control of yourself, so you face that terrible dilemma.
That expresses better than I can why, even though the pressures on me eased as we grew in capability and pages, the basic tension never receded. Another pillar on whom I knew I could rely was Jack Patterson. He had been ill with a blood clot in his leg and was not supposed to be on his feet too long, much less lifting heavy bundles, but he was in charge of the very complex problem of delivering the papers from all the small plants and later from the mailroom to the waiting trucks of the distributors in the face of all kinds of violence against the drivers, including being shot at. My son Don also helped me, not to mention the paper, enormously. Mark Mayer bore the overall responsibility for the company's planning in the strike and did so superbly. But, needing to look at the larger picture, and having his hands more than full planning our strategy, our negotiations, and our outside public relations, he had handed to Don the very difficult job of running the paper day to day. It was a heavy obligation for Don, at the age of 30, to have thrust on him, but he rose to the occasion magnificently, and getting his hands on the actual machinery used in putting out the paper taught him a lot. Finally, the people inside the building working to get out the paper were heroic. However, they added to my pressures by saying, "We don't mind doing this, but don't let us down," meaning, "Don't let the pressmen back, don't give in," as the Post had done too many times in the past. By October 12th, nearly 2 weeks into the strike, we were able to print our entire press run from our own plant. We now had four presses fixed, but were still printing only a 40-page daily paper, probably because we were beginning to get back on our feet sooner than I had thought possible, and to an extent that I would not have believed when I first saw the damage to the presses, I began to be more hopeful. Clearly there was progress on some fronts, however gradual. Our press crews were doing an amazing job. There were small milestones. For the October 15th paper, we had replated the front page for a later edition, giving readers news about the World Series and an automobile accident President Ford had been in. By October 16th, we had gone to 48 pages, the most we could publish without using a kind of printing called a collect run, which requires more people and longer press runs. We made a big leap forward when we started running collect. The advertising executives were on the presses and knew we were having to turn down advertising because we couldn't go up in pages. At first, Don was reluctant to let them do it, because it was trickier to pull off, and even dangerous for amateur press people,
but they prevailed. By Sunday, October 19th, our final edition had 9 sections and 206 pages. We had 8 men working in the stereotyping operation. For the October 23rd paper, these 8 men made nearly 600 plates for the presses, including 3 replates for a story on Franco, who was ill and assumed to be dying. The usual non-strike stereo staff consisted of 40 people. Other than meeting constantly with Mark and Don and others to assess how we were doing, I spent most of my time working at various jobs in the classified department, taking circulation complaints and keeping up in the mail room. Many women were working in the real room, making the flying pasters that permit newspaper presses to keep running when one of the huge newsprint rolls runs out. This, as we said at the time, was very likely the first time in modern newspaper history that women have been in this job. If you didn't prepare the new roll just right, the paper tore and stopped the press automatically. The process required a great deal of dexterity, and I was leery of the responsibility for breaking the web, which was extremely onerous to reweave. To my shame, I was unskilled enough to be reduced at times to picking up accumulated trash. But on the whole, we were growing really proficient at all our additional jobs, and the process of putting out the paper was getting more predictable. Over the months, we settled into a certain routine, more or less holed up in the building, with many people camped out, essentially living in their offices. Morale was high, especially in the first weeks, long before we ever thought the strike might stretch on as it did, and we did whatever we could to keep it that way. We served food on the 9th floor 3 times a day. After the press run at night, we also had food and light drinks available, and there was always a large gathering at which those who had produced the paper could get rehabilitated. The hired caterers, as part of their normal operation, wore black tie uniforms at night, and it introduced a note of incongruity when they appeared amid the din and confusion of the press room with juice and milk and sandwiches. Upstairs we had a piano, and several people played. Jake Lester, one of the electricians, often played his banjo while people sang along. Whatever entertainment we had was a way to release all the tension, but the Star's gossip columnist attacked us savagely, accusing me of entertaining strikebreakers with music and waiters serving gourmet food. I deeply resented people who didn't understand what we were going through or how much people were sacrificing to get the paper out. Staying in the building was no picnic. Conditions were difficult and exhausting. Every person was doing at least 2 jobs, his or her own regular job during the day, plus helping to put out the paper at night. Spouses were under great strain trying to make do at home alone, and often receiving threatening phone calls. Those living at the post rarely saw their husbands or wives or children. Some shaky marriages broke under the strain of having people live in the building, and, it has to be admitted, some romances started there as well. Many people came and went in their efforts to help us. My brother Bill more or less moved into the Madison Hotel across the street from the paper and worked at various jobs around the building, as did his daughter Ruth and her husband. Lally came down from New York with my granddaughter Catherine, then 9 years old, who stood on a box one Saturday night in the mailroom helping to wrap papers. But though certain activities had settled into a kind of routine, the worries remained constant. One of the biggest was whether we could keep the guild working. The guild leaders attacked us for a statement I had made earlier that the company's profits should rise to 15%, pointing out that we were the area's largest business and Washington's only corporation in the Fortune 500. Brian Flores called the company a wealthy conglomerate. They kept up a steady drumbeat on their members, trying to get them to honor the picket line. Only a handful of guild members had gone out for reasons I respected. One was John Hanrahan, a good reporter and a nice man who came from a long-time labor family and simply couldn't cross a picket line. He never did come back. Living your beliefs is a rare virtue and greatly to be admired. As for most of the other guild members who didn't work during the strike, I must confess that I would have been happy to see them never come back. Flores said that the guild would attempt to fine all its members who crossed the picket line 125% of everything they earned during the strike, and he threatened to expel those who had. This at a time when a majority of his union members repeatedly voted not to honor the picket line. The guild leaders worked hard to influence various organizations around the city toward its position. For example, Flores sent a telegram to the Washington Redskins urging the players not to talk with Post reporters, with notable lack of success. Flores also attacked me personally. In a citywide bulletin issued on the day I was to receive the Profiles in Courage Award for the Post's reporting of Watergate from the John F. Kennedy Lodge of B'nai B'rith in Chevy Chase, Maryland, he said, "One can't help but feel that any portrait of Kennedy should be turned to the wall while an award is presented to the commander of the forces which seek to wipe out labor unions at the Washington Post," adding, "Enjoy your dinner, Ms. Graham, while 2,000 of your employees are on strike or honoring picket lines. They too have the courage to fight for what they believe in and back it up with great personal sacrifice for them and their families. If JFK were alive, I am sure he would rather have dinner with them than you." At the same time, he stepped up the pressure on guild members inside the building to come out, which indeed 5 members of the foreign desk agreed to do. Other guild members, however, actually resigned from the guild to protest the position the guild's executive board took toward the strike. The pressmen, too, stepped up their attacks, including personal ones on me. In one flyer they circulated toward the end of October, titled "The Washington Post Cover-Up," they said that the owners of the Post hoped to get away with the biggest cover-up this town has seen since Watergate. I was accused of having hired Larry Wallace, whom they tried to depict throughout the strike as some sort of union buster, and described as fresh from his vicious attack on the workers at the Detroit Free Press. They alleged that he then presented me with a Gordon Liddy-like plan to destroy the Post's unions, which I, according to them, had approved. We also worried about the constant threat of violence. At one point, 3 holes were made in the 5th-floor glass windows of several editorial offices, evidently caused by a powerful air gun firing metal pellets. Roughness on the picket line became habitual. Many people who drove their cars to work found them with flat tires caused by nails and large tacks spread across the alley entrance. Others were followed to their cars and harassed. Finally, with the idea of safety in numbers, we began to use a large van to transport people to other locations throughout the city where they could pick up their cars or get a bus. Spouses were regularly called and threatened violently and obscenely. One employee's wife was actually told, "We're going to kill you and the baby if we see you on the street." An older woman, a union-exempt employee, was told that she had better sleep with her eyes open, and on another occasion, that she was going to have her head blown off. Once, when Jimmy, my driver, was at the wheel of my car, several picketers stopped the car as we were crossing the line and rocked it back and forth. The pressmen also increased their efforts on other fronts, including picketing our advertisers, for which we filed an unfair labor practice charge, alleging a secondary boycott. Among the other negative things the union was doing were passing out handbills for a consumer's boycott and trashing the stores of advertisers by dumping goods off shelves. In one case, several striking pressmen poured oil into a store's fish tank, killing all the fish. In addition to the constant threat, if not reality, of violence, we had several other worries as the strike dragged on into November. The city room began to get even more edgy. Many reporters were suffering deeply from pangs about crossing the picket line. I received 2 communications then from guild members who were still working. One, addressed to both Larry Wallace and me, was signed by 41 people. They were writing to ensure that their presence in the building wasn't taken as blanket approval of the Post management's conduct of its labor relations and demanding reassurance that we were continuing to bargain in good faith. I assured them that we were, and that we wanted all the unions back, with the exception of those pressmen who had engaged in the violence. A few days later, another letter arrived from about 80 members of the Post unit of the Guild. This letter included 20 specific questions to which they wanted answers. They acknowledged the damage done to the pressroom, but pointed out that this issue was now in the legal justice system. The signers felt that, more than a month having passed since the beginning of the strike, There should have been further signs that the company was acting to settle the dispute. They added, "We have subjected ourselves to punitive action by our own union and possibly split our ranks beyond repair. While you may choose to think kindly of us when guild negotiations come up next year, we would prefer not to have to rely on your benevolence, but to go into contract negotiations as a strong union. Your response to the following questions will help us make up our minds. It is our feeling that through your response you may make a demonstration of good faith that would help rebuild the crumbling management-labor relationship at the post." Obviously, my replies were going to be extremely important. The answers to the 20 questions were drafted and worked over at great length by Don, Meg, and me. From my point of view, some of the questions were irrelevant and silly, such as the reason for the amount of severance paid to Paul Ignatius when he left in 1971. Even so, this was a good chance for us to communicate our views. One important statement was this: "There is one crucial aspect of all this, however, that your letter leads me to believe you have failed to take into account. It is that the violence, both in the pressroom last month and in various episodes since, has profoundly altered and complicated our good faith search for a settlement. Before October 1st, we had the luxury of being able to seek a gradual, phased solution to the problems in the pressroom. When I say we do not have the luxury now, I mean that it would, in my judgment, be the ultimate act of irresponsibility on our part to permit the pressmen to return under the old conditions. I could not myself in good faith preside over a building or an enterprise in which people who had worked faithfully and to the point of exhaustion for the company were in continuing physical danger from fellow employees, in which those who control a whole section of our building, while those who had worked to repair the damage to the company and to get the paper out, had to be transferred elsewhere to get them out of harm's way, in which hiring and manning practices permitted not just the same kind of feather bedding, but also the same importation of men likely to commit the same kinds of violence should they be crossed. The pressmen in the early morning hours of October 1st made it impossible for us to set it as some future desirable goal that we should be allowed to have management supervisors present in the pressroom. We need a contract that is fair to our pressmen. We also need a contract that is fair to us. I would deceive you if I said this result would be easy to achieve, or that it is a sure thing that it can be achieved at all. But we are trying. I want you to understand that." I went on to answer each of the long technical questions: how the pressmen would be paid, what the post's new position on collective bargaining was, why I had set a profit goal of 15%, why we had trained management employees to operate the presses in the first place, why we let guild people help us, whether we were leaning on other publishers to get the pressmen blacklisted, what our position was toward indicted or convicted pressmen. We finally got our responses completed and sent our answers out, as well as posting them around the building on bulletin boards, where clusters of people immediately gathered to read them. One reader was overheard to murmur, "There is one question missing." When asked what it was, he replied, "Mrs. Graham, how is your sex life?" Guild members who were not working met together outside the building and called themselves the Rank and File Strike Support Committee. They issued at least 14 pamphlets during the weeks of the strike, trying to get the post's other guild members to come out with them. It seemed particularly ironic that we were questioned about whether we were negotiating in good faith, but that they never asked the pressmen the same question. The Star, understandably, took every advantage there was to take. At one point, we learned that some of the pressmen who ordinarily worked at the post, possibly as many as 40, were working at the Star. It didn't make us feel better when we heard that the pressmen's union said that most of the money these men earned there was being contributed to a central strike fund. Yet, despite all that our competition was doing, we overtook the Star, at least in terms of pages published, on October 23rd, only 3 weeks after the strike began, and during the last week in October, the Post became profitable again for the first time since October 1st, a remarkable accomplishment. But also, by the end of the month, the Star had gained $2 million in revenue over the year before and was up in advertising by 2 million lines. Much had poured into the Star because the Post couldn't print it. The Star ran in the black that October for the first time in 60 months. Its operating losses, according to an article in the Post at the time, had been running at a rate of nearly $1 million a month, so its advertising increase was certainly helping to offset the losses. We knew that the Star, despite its current surplus of revenues over expenses, had a more than $20 million debt, but we also knew that Joe Albritton had deep pockets. I felt we were being lambasted in the press for being Goliath to the brave little David, partly through what I thought were stories planted by our competition. I certainly believed that the Star was doing everything it could to hurt us. Nevertheless, because we had to live together in the same town, and in fact had helped each other in many ways over the last 40-plus years of my family's ownership, I also believed in maintaining civil relations. Consequently, on December 3rd, I rushed back from New York, where I'd been for an ANPA meeting, to attend a reception at the Mayflower in honor of Joe Albritton. I made the effort to go through the receiving line and tried to say something nice to Joe. However, on my way out, my breath was literally taken away when someone showed me a cartoon being circulated around the party. It was drawn by Oliphant, the Star's cartoonist at the time, and used the famous Mitchell quote to depict me brutally with my breast caught and drawn out at length in a wringer, this one from a press. I found it terribly wounding, said nothing, and left. One group or another started leaning on us to be reasonable. In mid-November, Mark, Don, Larry Wallace, and I went up to Capitol Hill to meet with the local members of the House whose constituents were most affected. These representatives, two from Maryland and two from Virginia, and Walter Fauntroy from the district, wanted to offer their services to find out what the strike was about and to step in. When they found out that the pressmen's union was all male and all white, the one black pressman had been hurt and left the paper before the strike, their enthusiasm for supporting the union subsided somewhat. I ran into Arthur Goldberg, the windy pro-labor expert, at the home of a prominent civic leader in Washington, at one of the few dinners I attended during the strike. He assured me that in a strike, everyone had to give, and that it had to be settled. He had arbitrated an airline strike, and would be glad to step into ours. I responded rather sharply that we were doing fine, and I saw no need for his intervention then or ever. Other worries abounded. Though the paper was growing, and we were printing from our own plant, 14 of our circulation route dealers filed a class-action suit against us, complaining about our transition from independent contractors to an agency system of distribution. The Maryland Attorney General's office launched an antitrust investigation of the paper. The strike had occurred just 4 years after we had gone public, and we were still a relatively small company. Pending the outcome of the strike, industry analysts were withholding their assessments of our financial performance as a company, at best, or, at worst, reducing their estimates of our per-share earnings for the year, which clearly affected stock purchases. Larry Israel, Mark Mayer, and I told a New York financial analysts meeting that the strike would cause the first earnings drop we had experienced since we'd gone public. Time was an odd factor throughout the strike. If someone had told me at the beginning that 4.5 months later we would still be working at our regular jobs while helping out in departments everywhere in the building to produce a daily paper, I wouldn't have believed it. I would not have thought we could endure. Sometimes it's better not to know. I remember the first time I heard someone mention Thanksgiving. My immediate thought was, "That's impossible. We can't still be here by Thanksgiving, doing what we're doing under this strain and uncertainty." But Thanksgiving came and went, and the first time someone mentioned Christmas, I thought the same thing. As we began to experience more and more success, and to settle into the routine reality of putting out the ever-growing paper, the early euphoria diminished, a process helped along by fatigue and even boredom, both of which contributed to an erosion of spirits and morale. One editor on the presses said he began to understand what blue-collar workers felt like, constantly performing a tedious and thankless yet difficult job, while the white-collar executives upstairs made decisions that affected their lives and their work. Although the pressure did decrease a bit, as we became more successful, there was still no way to tell when it would all end and how it would turn out, so the anxiety and the grinding quality of life remained. I worried incessantly that the total exhaustion of our small workforce, particularly because it was getting harder to obtain the extra help we were using in small but essential quantities, would force us to give up in the end. Certain industry friends, especially Frank Batten, chairman of the private Landmark